Hello, and welcome to the Language of Mindfulness podcast. This is a podcast for people who want to have more great conversations in your life. You want to connect, you want to speak authentically, and you want to listen deeply. This is how to do it, and it's the real deal. So why should you listen to the Language of Mindfulness? Because in every episode, I'm going to give you tips and guidance I've learned in my pretty extensive career of coaching and practice from the best and brightest in the field of interpersonal communications, public speaking, meditation, group leadership, and somatic psychology. And we're going to have interviews with some amazing people about their groundbreaking work. It's my goal to give actionable and uncommon tips and advice in every episode that you can implement right away. So subscribe or follow now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And if you don't listen, you're going to miss some great stuff that you just won't hear anywhere else. I'm your host, Brett Hill, and welcome to the Language of Mindfulness. Well, I am really beyond excited today to welcome to the Language of Mindfulness, Kristen Moody. She is an empathy scholar, coach, and educator who uses the science of empathy to build authentic connection across diverse people. She's inspired by the biological instinct humans have to empathize with one another and the potential empathy has to address the most pressing threats to civilization. She first learned about the power of empathy as a high school teacher, where she saw the impact relationship building had on student-teacher outcomes. Kristen went on to formally study empathy and integrate that understanding into support for individuals and organizations seeking improved culture, equity, and access to authenticity. She now teaches, researches, and explores empathy frameworks to help diverse people connect in ways that promote, celebrate, and leverage authentic diversity. A proud graduate of the Baltimore School for the Arts, Kristen is part of the founding board for Atlanta School for the Arts. She enjoys boxing, learning sign language, and volunteering as a reader for the Georgia Radio Reading Service. So I'd like to welcome Kristen Moody to the show. It's so exciting to have you here.
Thanks, Brett.
Wow, I mean, this is such an interesting bio. I mean, like, you know, when I do these bios for some people, it's sort of like, oh, they've got books and they do this, but this is like, wow, okay, so where do I even start? You are an empathy academic, right? So most people will talk about, yeah, I'm an empathetic person and I kind of teach empathy, but I've never run into an empathy academic. So can you explain to us a little bit about what that means?
To be fair, there are some phenomenal empathy academics out there that would totally say that I am not enough of an academic to claim. So there are some, and these people are absolutely getting their due right now.
Yay.
A guy named Jamil Zaki, who, if he needs someone to make his coffee, I'm his girl. There's people out there, Dr. Akif Nuu, who's studies under him. There's a whole team at Stanford that's doing a lot of work around empathy right now. And they're all folks that I studied and whose research I cited heavily when I was studying empathy at University of Southern California. So those are the folks who are employed by universities, whose full-time job it is to research empathy all the time. So they're like writing the papers that I'm reading for my work. So the fair thing to say is that there's a whole classification of people who get to do this all the time. They work in labs. They have like a functional MRI machine that they can use to like see where empathy is lighting up in your brain. And I'm not that. I'm that space in between who uses all their research and spends a lot of time reading their research to make it applicable for people in the field. So I like to think of myself as the bridge between the people in the lab and the people who need to make the work in the lab applicable.
Right. So you're reading the work that they're doing and, you know, work that you studied, formally studied.
I did when I was at the University of Southern California. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, what kind of a degree do you get when you study empathy?
So my doctorate is actually in organizational leadership and change, and my research was on the role that empathy has in making sustainable change. And as you noted, you know, it says in my bio, that was sort of born out of how important I saw empathy was in my work in schools as a teacher, but then also as an administrator, and seeing how important that still was in the relationship that administrators had with the people that they led, but then continuing to see that as a consultant and then as a coach.
So let's talk a little bit about the mechanics of empathy, if you don't mind. I'm kind of a geek, not kind of, I am a geek. I worked for big tech companies, and yeah, I'm as geeky as they get. And so I'm really curious, because one of the things about me is I've always been driven by how things work. I like to get into the insides, the mechanics and stuff. So it's like, how do people, and the reason I'm even intersected you is because I'm taking some classes at the Mindfulness Coaching School, and Kristen is teaching this fabulous class there on the business of coaching. But I like to get kind of to understand what makes people tick. Like, what, how does personality kind of work in the world? How does this person kind of express who they are, and where's their rub, and where do they light up, and what's under the hood with all that really lights me up? And so empathy is a big part of that. And I'm curious about how it is that you landed on, okay, so you're in class and you see the relationships, but how did you land on that it's empathy, the thing that is what you want to study, is what you wanted to like really focus on?
I think it was a lot of arguing with people about what empathy isn't, and trying to figure out what the word was or what the concept was that encompassed what I saw that was so pivotal, right? And so I think being a classroom teacher and working in high schools, I come from having worked in schools that were predominantly schools where I, as a white woman, was working a lot with Black and Latinx students. And so when I would talk a lot about the importance of the relationship that I had with those students, especially not having the same racial identity as my students, and I would talk about the importance of the relationship, if I used a word like empathy, sometimes people are like, well, we don't need you to feel sorry for the kids that you're working with. And So the conflation of empathy and sympathy was one of the first things I encountered. And I really, really appreciated the science behind how empathy is applied in the medical field, where we can see racial equity gaps in medical outcomes closed by empathy interventions for medical professionals. When medical professionals are receiving formalized, codified trainings around how to accurately interpret various different cues about how someone's feeling, and use that to drive behavior, it closes racial equity gaps. To me, I thought, there's science there. Why aren't we applying that in the education space? Why are we conflating sympathy and empathy? I love the way that empathy is used very practically in the user-centered design space. If we can use it to drive a profit around, like, in engineering, why weren't we using it to drive the way that we were engaging people in a nonprofit space, how we're serving people in therapeutic services? So that was I could see empathy being codified as a principle in some fields and doing really important things, but then dismissed as like a soft skill, often a gendered soft skill, right? And somehow less important in other spaces. So I went to the places where it was being codified and operationalized as a critical performance tool. And that's where I found out, oh, well, you've got people like Jamil Zaki, you've got people like Desity, who are studying empathy not as a fuzzy, soft thing, but as a series of complex physiological processes that all typically functioning humans have, that are part of our evolution, designed to advance the propagation of the species, because we're social animals and need it to survive.
Right. I mean, in your bio, it talks about empathy as needed to help address the most pressing threats to civilization. Right. And I hear that, and kind of that lights up for me. I'm go, oh, wow. It's not just a good idea. It's like it's necessary for our survival, is what I hear you saying there. And you were talking also about, you know, building bridge technically from the technical stuff to getting into, and I'm hearing you talk about the various cultures in the school and how to build bridges. So it seems to me like bridge builder person is kind of in your persona. Am I reading into that, or is that?
No, I definitely. I guess I use that language a lot without even being aware of it. So that's. Mm. There's some good coaching happening there, Brett. No. I definitely feel like, you know, one of the things that I think is important about empathy that people miss is a lot of times the way that I always heard empathy is that, oh, it's you put yourself in another person's shoes. And if you've ever experienced something similar, it can make it easier, right? Oh, I've had the same experience, and then that makes it easier. Mm-hmm. But what empathy really is and what our physiology equips us to do is really be able to interpret what someone else is experiencing, not what it was like when we experienced it, but to really be able to actively listen and engage. And so much of what is happening in our world now prevents us from having the mindfulness and the present moment awareness to really engage with others. And so, you know, I'm on my phone, or I'm thinking about what's happening next. And so I'm not picking up on your body language. I'm not checking in with your facial expression. I'm getting a lot of messages from the media or things that I've been told that make me second guess what you say, or
right
make me unpack what you say, so I don't trust what you have to say, instead of me really hunkering down and listening.
And so, how do you get people to that place, though? Because, like you say, so much of it is we're on automatic, and there's so much input into our systems and biases and thousands of messages coming at you constantly. How do you get people's attention long enough to be able to say, pay attention, and here's how to pay attention? Like, is there a mechanics to that? And once you grab a hold of it, how do you help people to kind of really see? Because by the way I hear you say, I mean, this is a really, really see and really listen. Can you, if you're teaching people how to do that, what's that process like?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of research on what effective empathy interventions look like. Mm-hmm. And what we know is that all typically developing humans have some range of empathy within them, because we all have physiology for it, right? We're all interpreting facial expressions unconsciously. We're all cluing into the way that other people feel without choosing to. And so that flies in the face of a lot of what we're socialized to believe. We're often told, you know, humans, it's, you know, it's actually in our biology to, like, empathy is counter to our biology, and it's all like me first, right? And every man's out for himself. We're told that that's in our instinct, but that's not actually true. And so I think that some of the work is just letting people know we're actually hardwired to care about each other. Mm-hmm. We actually have physiological processes that equip us to care about each other. Mm. And it's in our nature. We're socialized to reject some of them, but it's in our nature to care about each other. It's in our best interest to care about each other. It's not bad for you to care about each other. It's actually good for you. You get high from it. Yeah. You have a release of oxytocin that goes into your bloodstream, and it makes you high and engages your parasympathetic nervous system. So even when you're empathetically connecting over something that is stressful or tumultuous, you're still getting, you know, dopamine and serotonin and oxytocin releases, and it gets you high because you know, it's good for the human race for us to connect with one another, right? So all of that sort of malarkey that we're taught that it's bad for you, that's not true. So that's the good news. And I think when people hear that, that piques people's interest, right? There's that.
Yeah.
I also think that what a lot of the research shows about empathy interventions that are effective is that when you can tie empathetic connection to goals that we have, it makes it easier. When we're often told that caring about other people or connecting with other people is counter to our goals, then it makes it feel like what we should be doing is proceeding throughout the world with blinders on. I should just focus on me. It's exhausting to care about other people. Everybody says that I just need to worry about myself, right? Mm-hmm. Being empathetic is going to burn me out and whatever. So when we can start to look at, you know, I did a training with some mental health professionals a few months ago, and we talked about the fact that when you are focused on other things and have a very surface level interaction with your clients over and over and over again, all you get is the negativity.
Mm-hmm.
And you never get the high of the connection. So truly you're more likely to burn out if you don't ever get the high of the connection. So compassion fatigue is a very real thing, but so is present body awareness and self-care and mindfulness strategies to reset. But if you don't ever give yourself access to the empathetic connection, you actually deprive yourself of all of the things that make helping professions positive. And right. So if you decide you're going to turn it all off to avoid compassion fatigue, you've actually turned off all the possibility for it to ever be rewarding. So we look at what are the goals that we have and how can we align empathetic connection to some of the goals.
Wow. So, okay, so let me just sit with this for a second. In the process of protecting ourselves, we disconnect from the things we need in order to further ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then you wind up, you know, with a self-reference sort of framework walking around the world. And eventually that creates, you know, these silos that are very hard to kind of break through. And so where we're at now is this process of like trying to deal with the short circuits that creates when we see each other and we relate to these complex issues, particularly in a hybrid, an amplified situation like we're in with all the, division that we have going on and the hyper-amplified amplifications of those divisions. So the means then to break through to that, I'm thinking you could actually then approach this in two ways. You could begin to help people by focusing inward and begin to become aware of this isolation or this the way they disconnected, or you could have people focus on an other and it still opens the same door. Would that be right?
This is true. I mean, present body awareness, mindfulness is one of the most critical strategies for empathy. It's the way that I came to mindfulness. So I started exploring mindfulness when I discovered how critical it was to building empathetic practice. Reluctantly, I was a boxer first.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk about that too.
I mean, I can remember my boxing coach, you know, giving me a really hard time about how distracted I was in the ring and saying that we were going to start, trainings with like some breathing and some like mini meditation. He's very into some Eastern martial arts and Eastern, you know, sort of religious framing. And we were going to do meditation. And I about walked, I was like, I would go to yoga if I wanted that stuff. I'm not.
Yeah, right. This is the boxing ring.
I don't want to do that. And so when I saw the connection between, you know, the present body awareness and mindfulness and how critical that is for you to pick up cues from other people, to be able to tap into your own empathetic physiology, I started, you know, I went to like a MBSR retreat. I took a class, still very reluctant participant.
Yeah.
But I know I've seen the science. I don't have a choice. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I know empathy, like mindfulness, is a practice. And if you want to build it, you can turn it off, you can turn it on. And if you want to be able to control it, and if you want to be able to build it, then being able to be aware, being able to be present, being able to be mindful is really critical, which also means that if I want to be, I'm somebody who is very susceptible to picking up other people's emotions. That's called emotional contagion. That's not empathy. They're different. So I am
Oh,
somebody who's really
nice.
susceptible to emotional contagion. And so I know that if I want to be somebody who moves throughout the world without picking up other people's crappy moods, that mindfulness is critical for that too.
So let's talk about that because I encounter people all the time, and the line is like, I'm so empathetic. Other people drain me all the time. I walk around, someone walks in the room, and I'm taking on all of their emotions, and they leave, and I'm a mess. And it's because I don't know how to manage my empathy. What do you say to someone like that? Is that this emotional? They're just they're are is that really empathy? An empathy management problem, or is that some other kind of problem?
Well, so I mean, so different fields define empathy in different ways, which is part of the reason that it's so misunderstood, right? But, psychologists would call empathy, they would say it has like three sort of elements, right? There's affective empathy, which is where I understand your emotions. There's cognitive empathy, which is where I understand what you're thinking. And then there's the empathy that I actually do something about, right? Like there's actual behavioral. So the idea of emotional contagion, this idea that I'm picking up your emotional state, is absolutely absent cognitive empathy. The inverse of that is what a lot of user-centered design folks, right? Which is where I spend a lot of time understanding where you're coming from, but don't necessarily understand the emotions behind it. If I'm redesigning public transport, I can spend a lot of time riding MARTA or BART or whatever the New York Metro, right, to understand how people are experiencing public transportation, but I don't ever actually understand the frustration of it because at the end of the day, I'm going to go get in my car. So I've never actually understood the burden of having to rely on it. The effective empathy part is missing. So if we have those three kinds of empathy, right? One that's about emotions, one that's about like understanding the cognitive space, and one that's about actually how we act, then the idea would be that people who are experiencing this emotional contagion are people who are most experiencing only effective empathy. And the challenge with that is that the challenge with that is that the without checking in with somebody's cognitive empathy, you actually don't know how accurately you are. Now, I can tell you that I'm somebody who experiences a lot of emotional contagion. If I go through the checkout line, this is the example I always give, and the clerk is having a crappy day, my day is now crappy. I would also tell you that that means like in the I'm low man on the food chain, right? It has to do with power structure. And if I have had a good meal and a solid night's sleep and I had a great workout that day, you also can't bring me down. So it says something about my headspace that I am that I'm in that space that I can absorb somebody else's mood. If we were truly that susceptible to emotional contagion, we'd be just as likely to walk around capable of picking up everybody's great moods. And I'd be walking around like, I just keep picking up all these people's great moods. We're usually talking about picking up people's heavy moods.
And is that a neurological bias? It's kind of like we're neurologically wired to amplify the negative experiences that we have,
That's
because
a
of,
human thing. Negativity bias is a thing, right? And so on the scale of, there's a researcher, Baron Cohen, who says that like empathy can be rated on a scale of like 1 to 7, with 7 being like the highest, that maybe those people are most emotionally in tune. But it's literally like a physio it's a set of physiological processes. I'm interpreting your facial expression, I'm interpreting your body language, I'm interpreting your vocal intonation. My mirror neurons are firing in the place that my would if I was in that mood. It's sending a message to my brain. My facial expression is starting to mimic yours, right? Like, and my brain is starting
Mirroring,
to go, you're actually angry. Your shoulders are slumping, and so now my shoulders start to creep forward. And my brain is starting to go, you're depressed, even though I just had the best day. So the truth is that if I'm really in a positive emotional state, if I'm really emotionally healthy, if I'm in a really good spot, that's not going to happen to me as much. So that has to do with present body awareness, mindfulness, how well I'm taking care of this.
So you can notice the impact without adopting the impact. You know, it's like, oh, this is causing me like this and I feel this way. Oh, I'm noticing these things. That's not me. I'm just noticing them, you know.
Because if I'm making a connection with someone and we're sitting down and we're talking, you're telling me about this really heavy thing that's happening, that connection that happens is something that makes us feel, even if I'm connecting with you and we're sharing the sadness, it's a heavy thing. Oh, I can't believe this is happening. I'm so sorry this is happening to you. That connection that happens between us is something that makes us both feel good on some level. It does release chemicals in our brain, into our bloodstream. That connection, it creates an in-group between us.
Yes,
it creates a bond. Like those things, they don't cancel out the bad. But it's why if you've had a horrible day and you can talk to somebody about it, the weight is lifted. You start to feel lighter. The tears start to dry. Those things happen because of the connection.
Well, you know, we're relational beings in the framework I come from is, you know, it's like who we are. Our whole identity is all around how we interact with the world and others. And, you know, you walk into a room and someone's really, your parents are like really agitated and mean, and you develop an orientation to the world that's like, well, I can walk into a room and things can be agitated and mean. People that I care about can come at me like in an angry way. And I need, and that's my world. You know, that's the world I live in. And so you kind of adopt that kind of a mindset about your world. And that's how we learn who we are. So I totally hear what you're saying. I mean, that's how we kind of unlearn in a way who we identify with that as our experience. But who we are, I think, is something deeper. And I wanted to ask you, oh my God, boxing. When I first saw you box, I'm going, wait, I don't know anyone who boxes. And then when, as I was, you know, in these classes I was taking with you and I'm learning, I'm going, I'm trying to imagine and thinking about the boxing and I'm going, and I can tell it's an important thing for you. And I just want to find out, how did you wind up in that world? And I feel like there's a teaching story here and I want to know something about what did you learn from about boxing is your teacher, right? There's got to be some jewel in there I want to know about.
I just love it. I mean, you know, I've been boxing for almost 10 years now. And I took a couple months off after the first time that I fought. And other than that, I've met with my trainer, even in the pandemic, I mean, every week. I think I'm terrible at it. And so there's something about boxing that keeps me, I don't like to do many things that I'm terrible at. And so, there's something really important to me about continuing to go back and loving something that I'm not necessarily, that's not easy for me.
Wow. That's I love. A lot of courage in that.
I'm old for boxing, right? So, and I don't compete much. You know, I used to spar a good bit and I, you know, with COVID and everything, I laid off. But before that I have, I can't remember if I've shared this in class before. I have a chronic migraine. So I got a headache about 4 years ago that hasn't gone away, and treatment for that ended up interfering with some of the boxing. But I'm also just, you know, I'm older. I would be sparring, you know, people that were literally half my age and get my butt, you know, kicked, which is a real dose of humility. Yeah. But I love it. And,
but why, you know, what is it about it that you love?
Gosh, what don't I love? It's like dancing. The gym that I go to, where I live here in Atlanta, I have a coach who I love, named Phil Oliver, but there's another coach. It's very complicated, but I have another coach also. His name is Biggs. The place is called Decatur Boxing Club. That place is magic.
Magic.
It stinks and everything's grimy and everyone who goes in there is real. And there's just something pure. There's nothing that you can fake about boxing. People come in and they think they're really tough. I did it the first time I went in. I was like, oh, I can do this. And I went in the first time and I couldn't make it through. I don't think I made it four rounds. It's exhausting. It's you can't fake your way through it at all. It's the most authentic, hardest. You get these, we'll have sometimes famous people come in and out of that gym, and they'll come in really tough, and they've got like really fancy, like gym clothes.
All this
And
swag, right?
yeah, and
Yeah.
like everybody's gross. And like 6 minutes, you go 1 3-minute round, and it's the longest 3 minutes of your life. You think you could do anything for 3 minutes? That's not true. Like, 3 minutes of boxing is like 90 minutes of literally anything else. I don't know.
Wow, that is
It's
so amazing.
pure. It's
It's
pure.
pure. Yeah, there's something very raw and pure and primal about this whole experience.
And being present for those 3 minutes, especially if you're getting your butt kicked or especially if you're doing the wrong thing,
It
is like
matters,
has been
right?
incredible.
It's like I need to do this right, and it matters. Yeah,
Yeah. It's
right.
incredible.
Wow. Well, thank you for that insight. That's really powerful. I mean, you really painted a beautiful somatic world. I could just sort of step into there, and I could just kind of be with you for a minute in the gym. It felt like it was really beautiful. There's one other question I wanted to ask you, because you, which has caught my attention in your bio. It says that you explore empathy frameworks. Can you, does that mean something specific, an empathy framework?
I think there's just lots of different ways of talking about it, right? And so I think that, like I said, psychologists talk about empathy. There's affective, there's cognitive. They talk about empathy in terms of how it's being interpreted. And there's Teresa Wiseman, who is quoted by Brené Brown, which probably made her blow up. But she wrote a paper that Brené Brown quoted, and then I think it made it like the most widely like searched. But her definition of empathy, which has other people have sort of modulated and I've riffed off of, but one of the things that Teresa Wiseman's empathy definition talks about that I appreciate is this idea of actively listening without judgment. And I think the reason it's important in the medical field, but is important in other space, different framing, right? In psychology, we're talking about understanding what you're thinking versus understanding how you're feeling. This sort of approach is the idea of accurately understanding how you're feeling, accurately understanding what you're saying, and then not judging those things. And I think right now, when I think about where we are with technology, and Zaki talks about this in his most recent book, social media gives us access to an unreasonable amount of alignment. Because we can access anyone, we can access people that we expect to agree with us on everything. And that makes us believe that any amount of diversity is somehow lacking in morality, right? If I can find someone, I can connect with people in England, I can connect with people in Palestine, I can connect with people in Madagascar who like the same band I like, they go to the boxing gym, they also knit on a Saturday. And so because I can find people who I have that much in common with anywhere in the world, it makes the idea that somebody could have this one thing that's different seem unreasonable. And so we fall into these sort of, it's like the greater access has given us these narrower echo chambers.
Oh, I see
We've
what you're
become
saying.
an intolerant of diversity of thought. Forget diversity of identity. My friend circle can be full of different racial identities, different gender identities, different sexual orientations, religion, but we all believe the same things politically, But it's the diversity of thought that seems to be the place that we have the least amount of tolerance. And if you believe something different, it equates to amorality right now. And I think that these different frameworks for empathy, then, whether it's you're looking at nursing or you're looking at user-centered design or you're looking at, sociology or psychology, gives us different ways to unpack different problems. Because when I'm looking at how people have become intolerant of diversity of thought, I actually want to look at Teresa Wiseman's definition in nursing, because in nursing, they're using that definition to help nurses close gaps in equity and medical outcomes. Mm-hmm. Because I need you as a nurse to believe that I'm in pain. When I'm covered in tattoos and you're thinking, there's no way she's, with all the pain she's experienced, I don't believe her. She Wow. just wants the drugs. Wow. She just wants the drugs, right? So I need the nurse to believe me that I am actually in pain and look to see what else is going on and not jump to some assumptions based on what she thinks the way that I look means, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that same definition, that framework we can apply to helping to break past some preconceived notions we have about different political ideas, right? Mm-hmm. But the psychologist's perspective, the effective, the maybe that's going to be helpful for us to think about how a therapist might use empathy in a clinical setting. Mm-hmm. 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 How to actually set up the way in which they're meeting with clients.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know that there's work going on along those lines. I'm sure empathy is a part of the conversation. Dr. Ron Siegel at Harvard teaches a lot about mindfulness in the client-therapist relationship, and so he's doing good work there too. Wow, there's so much here. But I wanted to just kind of wrap all this up and go, whoa, you're such a big experience on my radar, and I'm sure a force in the world. And I'm grateful for who you are in the world and the force that you are. How can people listening to this find you?
So I have a new website coming. It's not Woo-hoo. There yet, but I have a new website coming. I said I was going to, and it will be corsillum.co. That's corsillum.co. But they can also find me at just kristinmoody.com.
kristinmoody.com. Okay, mm-hmm. Great. And I would see, and I would advise people, look her up, get on the phone, use her as a coach. Check it out, because this goes deep, folks. And so thank you so much for showing up and talking us through a little bit of your world. It's an amazing world, and I appreciate it so much.
Thank you for the opportunity, Brett.
So that's a wrap on today's edition of the Language of Mindfulness podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it. If so, please leave us a review on iTunes and follow along on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. We'd really appreciate it. And check us out at languageofmindfulness.com, where you can sign up for a free coaching session or download our PDF on 8 ways to be more mindful in a virtual meeting at languageofmindfulness.com/8, number 8, ways. Thanks a ton, and we're looking forward to a lot of great new content coming up as well. Have a great one, and stay present.